to grow and to maneuver. So I think there needs to be a kind of stronger emphasis on particularly working class people, but also you know, people in rural and small town areas who feel sort of neglected by the mainstream. And if that's there, I believe they wouldn't go to the kind of extreme option.
One last question. Do you think this is a party that has a viable and real path to proper power in the country?
Well, the incident that I sort of allude to in my article as well is that there are upcoming state elections. Germany is a highly devolved country where areas like education, policing and so on are down to the individual states to manage. And in one of these states, in Saxony-Anhalt, they're not far off an absolute majority right now. So if they get a few more percentage points, they could take over one of the 16 states, and that would be quite a powerful foothold in the federal system.
That was Katja Hoyer, the German-British historian. Thank you for joining me. And that is it from me today. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was the technical operator. And up next, it is, of course, Jane and Fee.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Danny. 2 o'clock now and welcome. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
And in the next 2 hours, the Children's Commissioner will tell us what she makes of the huge overhaul of the special educational needs system. Violence erupts in Mexico after a drug lord was shot dead, including in a city meant to host World Cup matches. We'll ask an expert on cartels if it really will be safe for fans. We'll open the doors of our literary salon after 3:30 with Susie Goldsborough of the Times book team. And that photo of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has been hung in the Louvre, at least until security notice. We will discuss where protest meets art.
And first of all, we're going to start with the news. At 2 o'clock, here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The man who killed three people in Nottingham in 2023 carried out an earlier attack after being released by mental health professionals. Valdo Callicane was let go because of the overrepresentation of young black men in custody. The council, to a public inquiry which began today, said that just 40 minutes after Callicane was released in 2020, he began to kick down a neighbour's door. He was then sectioned and released in late 2022. Callicane killed students Grace O'Malley Kumar and Barnaby Webber and school caretaker Ian Coates. Here's Barnaby's mother, Emma Webber.
This inquiry must not become a procedural exercise. It must expose the systemic failures that allowed these warning signs to be missed, risk to go unmanaged, and responsibility to be diluted. It's not about isolated errors. It's about whether the systems designed to protect the public are fit for purpose. And they're not.
The government says the cost of supporting pupils with special needs will keep rising until the end of the decade, despite an overhaul of the system. Education, Health and Care Plans, EHCPs, will be phased out for many children and replaced with specialist provision. But ministers say the number of EHCPs will continue to rise while the new system is phased in. The current cost is £12 billion a year. Jo van Herwegen, Professor of Developmental Psychology and Education at UCL, gives the plans a cautious welcome.
I think it's great that the government recognises that children should get support earlier, and it proposes that this will be done in terms of giving investment to run targeted and small group interventions. But that will mean that we need to give schools the resources but also the evidence in terms of what works for children.
Reform UK says it would restore Britain's Christian heritage by, among other things, stopping churches being converted into mosques. Zia Yusuf, the party's new Home Affairs spokesman, says renewing Britain's Christian's faith rather is vital to tackle what he calls the crisis of meaning culturally among young people and men in particular. Sally Hitchener, an Anglican priest, has told Times Radio she has reservations about this.
Historically has been characterised by a Christian country, but that hasn't always meant we've had Christian values. If you think about some of our history, we've treated other people in other countries in the world. I don't think we would necessarily want to replicate that if you're wanting to be following the teachings of Jesus. I think actually Christianity works best in a pluralistic society where there's freedom to choose.
The BBC has apologised for not cutting a racial slur from its BAFTAs coverage. A Tourette syndrome charity says it understands the harm that's been caused, but is also calling for more awareness of the condition. And after their successful Winter Olympics, Team GB are back home. They landed at Gatwick with their 5 medals, 3 of which are gold. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for a Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
5 minutes past two. Hello and welcome to Monday. Spring is in the air, double figures on the mercury, blue sky on the horizon. Who knows what might happen this week? It's Monday. By Friday, literally, who will know? It's Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We love your contribution to the afternoon programme. You can let us just bob along in the background if you want, but we also like it if you contact us. We're 0333 003 2353. We have a packed schedule for you. We're going to start with a question about the statementing of children. Send provision is in the news right now. Changes are afoot. Might you and your kids be affected? We have the Children's Commissioner on in a couple of moments. Time. That's Rachel D'Souza. Andrew is now in the Louvre, or he was for about 15 minutes when a group called Everyone Loves Elon hung that picture up. We're going to talk about the power of photography and protest. We also might have a couple of questions about security in French museums. We'll go to Mexico as well in the next half an hour of the programme to talk about the killing of a major gang player there and ask, well, I suppose it's a slightly kind of self-referential question about whether or not our fans will be safe going to Mexico for the World Cup this summer. Will the violence of the cartels quieten down in time? Our tech news comes from Chris Stoker-Walker. There's a fantastic piece by the Environment editor Adam Vaughan on the front page of the newspaper today about how much energy all of our little questions to ChatGPT and the other AI engines are actually costing us. And we've been talking about this for quite some time, haven't we, Jane? Because we cannot quite get our Luddite heads around the way that this technology is farmed and formed. But it is true, and this is the point that Adam is making in his piece. The headline is AI Revolution Will Create a Clean Energy Conundrum, that just at the point at which we're trying to curb our energy and look for greener ways to find our energy, we also have a surge of need. So it's the ultimate irony, isn't it? If you want to find out more about clean energy, you might ask ChatGPT something, and that's going to take an awful lot more energy to come back with an answer.
Well, it's like the old, it's too hot, let's get air conditioning. I've just made the whole situation worse.
It is exactly that. So we will talk about
what
that with Chris. don't worry. Because in Sport with Vassos, we might talk about snowball fights becoming an Olympic sport.
Yes, and we're also going to talk about England's calamitous performance in the Six Nations on Saturday afternoon.
Right, OK. I'm looking for joy. I'm just looking for tiny pieces.
Well, it's good
joy
if you're Irish.
We'll talk about books and money after 3:30. Oh, there's the joy, because Adam Shaw is going to tell us about car insurance coming down.
Lovely. OK, right. You see, there's always something to be positive about. 7 minutes past two. Keep in touch with us, 0333 003 2353. Brief look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, Nottingham killer was released by mental health workers informed by race research, a public inquiry has been told. The investigation into missed opportunities to stop Valdo Kalakane has heard evidence of his first encounter with mental health services. And at number two,
the queen of scandal, Sarah Ferguson's moment of reckoning as her ex-husband lies low after his arrest. The former Duchess of York is said to be in the UAE and penniless. Hilary Rose has written about Fergie for The Times, asking, how did it come to this? There's an extraordinary picture on the front of Times too, isn't there,
Ferguson. I couldn't really bear to look at it.
It's very decadent. She's dressed almost like a character from the French Revolution, and it doesn't sit well.
Hints of ancient Egypt.
It doesn't, Andrew Mountbatten, Windsor is the most read piece on the Times website, and this is the story that we're going to cover in about 20 minutes' time, too. Post-arrest picture hung in the Louvre for the protest group Everybody Hates Elon have put the photograph of Andrew leaving police custody in the Prism Museum. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. If you do sign up, it's not just today's articles you can read. You can access the full archive online. That includes in-depth interviews from the weekend's papers. Over the last couple of days, for instance, we've had revealing interviews with Lisa Minnelli, Tracy Emin, and also the hero of the Bondi Beach shooting, Ahmed Al-Ahmed. If you want to read those, plus all of the features from the Saturday and Sunday Times, you can just head to our website or app and check them out.
Times Radio, it is almost 9 minutes past two now. Education, health and care plans, known as EHCPs, will be reserved for children with the most complex special educational needs and disabilities by 2035, under a major overhaul of the current system. Ministers say that more children will instead be supported by their local schools in the hope of curbing the rapid growth in education plans, which has caused a multi-billion pound hole in local authority finances. Here is the Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson announcing the reforms a little bit earlier.
At long last, children with SEND get the rights they deserve. The right to be included in their local state schools. The right to enjoy the same high standards and expectations that we have for other children. And we are investing billions of pounds in mainstream schools to make them fit for children with SEND. To adapt classrooms and corridors. To train teachers and teaching assistants. To make specialist support ready.
That's the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson. What about the view of the Children's Commissioner for England? That is Dame Rachel D'Souza. I spoke to her earlier and she told me she doesn't think that parents of children with additional needs should panic.
So I think we're talking about long-term reforms, longer-term reforms. We're talking about what happens over the next 4, 5, 10 years. So I don't think there's any need to worry. And in fact, as Children's Commissioner, I have been given a role as an independent Children's Commissioner in this white paper to oversee the system. And I would say to that parent, I'll be making sure that your child does not lose support. And I think parents are absolutely fraught and have had a terrible time with the SEND system. It's totally understandable why they'd be worried. The whole system almost feels like it's up against parents and children. And that is actually why we need the change.
In your role as Children's Commissioner, is this the issue that takes up most of your time?
It certainly takes up a lot of time, and rightly, it's a big concern. So, I mean, if you just think about the size of the issue, about sort of 9% of children, you know, have special educational needs and have plans for those, what towards that, about 4% of children are have very, very, very complex needs. They're the children who are Down syndrome, who've got spina bifida, cerebral palsy. I was in a hospice, fabulous hospice, Noah's Ark Hospice last week, where they were providing respite and social care to children who were literally strapped in a wheelchair, couldn't move except with their eyes. Those are the children, that percentage of children, you know, complex needs children, who will continue in the new white paper to have EHCPs. And in fact, I would argue it should be made even easier for them. Now, the interesting thing is that 4% figure is the same as about 10 years ago. What's grown that number, the number of children getting diagnosed now and getting plans for neurodivergence. So that's children with autism, ADHD, anxiety, emotionally based behavior. That's new. And it's not just new in the UK, and particularly since lockdown, right across the Western world, you see this massive uptick in that group of children. And I think what's happened is children with moderate needs, for their parents to get them any support, they have to push them down this sort of medical diagnosis to get an EHCP, because that's how it works. You have to get a diagnosis to get an education, health and care plan, and then support gets unlocked. And so you've got children being pushed there and a massive increase in special school and a massive increase of children on these plans. And that's the thing The bit that this white paper is really trying to address differently. Sorry, it's quite complex.
It is complex, yeah. And it's desperately worrying. And if your child is having a tough time, it really hurts. It hurts you as the parent, and it has such an impact on the rest of the family. The headline is today, from what I can gather, that care plans in the future will be reserved for the most complex cases by 2035. I think that's the date being quoted. But you're saying, look, those very vulnerable children, the ones you visited at the hospice, they're always going to be cared for. And yeah. Those with less challenging needs will be better off. But why will they be better off exactly?
Right. So at the moment, what you have is you have years of wait to get a diagnosis, fight for a plan. And then, frankly, many children, even when they get a plan, are not getting their needs met. Some are. If you've got very strong advocacy, you know, if you've got parents who can advocate for you and will take, you know, local authorities to tribunals and will, you know, can get things for their children, most sometimes, yeah. But actually, many children, even if they get an EHCP, are not getting what they need. What this is an absolute sea change. It's saying for most children, the best place to get care and support is in their local school. It's not to be bussed 2 hours away to go to a special school. It's to go to their local school. Now, the reason I'm a fan of this is because I've talked to hundreds and thousands of children, all, you know, who have special needs and additional needs, and they've told me they want to go to their local school, but they need support when they're there and they want it to work. And there is the challenge. The challenge is, if this new plan is going to work, we need to make sure special educational needs support is based properly in schools with units in family of schools. If you're not going to use the private special school 2 hours drive away, you know, it's got to come into your local school. We've got to get that provision in there. The other bit of this is there's a commitment in this white paper. And again, delivery, you know, and it becoming a reality is the next step, but the commitment is there, which is we'll deal with things early. So instead of waiting for years to get a speech and language therapist, there is a proposal for, you know, experts at hand. So you get a speech and language therapist immediately. Your school can just book it.
But hang on, book a person. They have to be available. They have to be trained. They have to be employed. Who are these? Are they there now?
So I think there is a shortage of ed psychs. There is a shortage of speech and language. I've been talking about this for years. But one of the problems is a lot of those professionals are pulled into this whole diagnosis and create this sort of legal care plan, you know, 4 years too late. But they're up there doing all that work, whereas we need them around schools early, giving children the support they need. And yes, it absolutely needs investment. We absolutely need more professionals doing it, and we absolutely need a major training program. And that is why when I spoke to you at the start, I said this is going to take years. This is not a tomorrow. This is about building a workforce, building training, building physical spaces in schools. You know, this is a big endeavor.
Right, so we need to keep holding the government's feet to the fire, and it might not always be a Labour government. It could be a different government in a couple of years. Are you confident that progress in this area, as you see it, will continue?
Look, there is definitely strong commitment. It's actually quite, and I don't say this lightly, I'm independent and I'm normally quite critical, but it is actually, I think, quite brave to bring this white paper. It shows some courage and some commitment. So I'm pleased to see that. But do you know what the million-dollar question is going to be in? What's the plan? What's the delivery? How much money? How quickly? So I think I absolutely and actually have a role in it to hold government's feet to the fire to do this. And I think everyone else will too. There is no plan to not support children. So I don't think that's the worry. I think I've just listened to the Secretary of State's speech, and she's talking about a multi-year, making progress over years and years. But this is an ambitious plan, and it's a massive change, and it needs doing. But to do it properly, I think we're all going to have to keep a close eye.
We also have to bear in mind that there's money to be made here, and maybe we should focus on this area a bit more than we do. Politicians, notably, I think Sir Ed Davey of the Liberal Democrats, has said that the system is expensive. This is the SEND system, because private equity companies get in there and they're making a load of money. What do you say about that?
Yeah, then they absolutely shouldn't. Look, there are some independent special schools that are really positive parts of the system, but it is not how you'd build a system if you were building it from the start. And the new vision is very much about actually special units, special schools being delivered locally, you know, in families of schools. I, both in this area and in the area of looked after children and children in care, I constantly speak out against profiteering. It's absolutely wrong. One of the things about this system is it's extremely expensive. The current system's extremely expensive. And if you start looking at companies that are profiteering and some delivering good service, some not, if you start looking at taxi fares, you start to see, if you start looking at tribunals that are lost, 13,000 tribunals of SEND parents taking the LAs to court. Local authorities lose 90% of the time. There's huge amounts of money there. And I want the money to go on the children. The money should be spent on the children. The taxpayer expects it to be. So I do think, if you like, morally, and, you know, just looking at this plan, it looks a lot better. It will deal with that. But again, you can't strike out, you know, you need to make sure that provision is built and done properly, and it's a multi-year job. We must not underestimate it. You cannot just write a vision paper and it happen.
Do you worry about those children who may very well have additional needs, but as you indicated earlier, they need an advocate? What if you don't have an advocate? If your mum, your dad, your carers are not equipped to take on the system on your behalf, what happens to you?
And that's one of the things that I find most heinous about the current system. Because having been a head teacher myself for nearly 20 years in areas that had high levels of disadvantage in the areas, I could see that the children without advocates would not get the support. The children without parents who could go fight for them would not get the support. That's why I am really unhappy with the current system. The new system that's been proposed in the white paper is genuinely, I think, attempting to be more equitable. So, you know, you're building provision in schools. People who know you most, your head teachers and parents, you know, teachers and parents will be working to make sure you get the support you need. And given that support will be where everybody goes, you know, I think, you know, apart from that very, very, very complex need children, then there is a far better chance at making sure every child gets what they need. But again, please do not underestimate the task. This is really complex. We've got hugely growing numbers of children, you know, with what has been defined as special educational needs, particularly in the neurodivergence area.
Right. Do we need, Rachel, to start a conversation about why that is and whether or not there's something going wrong with our environment or with our parenting?
So, you know, when I looked at the figures, I was so concerned. And again, I looked at the figures in Australia, in Canada, in America, exactly the same. You've got this massive uptick, particularly after lockdown, of these figures. And it's massively expanded. You can see it through the education healthcare plans, because it actually 30% of children with education health care plans have got them for autism. That just wasn't there before. Now, there are all sorts of theories about why that is. I went to see the chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, and I asked him to give me the evidence base for why this was. He couldn't. He said there are different views. So now the Department of Health under West Streeting is doing a mental health and neurodivergence prevalence review. So it's looking into this. I'm on that with 90 others. And we are trying to get to the bottom of all the evidence nationally and internationally so that we can try to answer that question. I'm only involved in the children bit, but it's looking at children and adults. We really do not know the answer. There are very different schools of thought. So I think almost this is the most essential first task.
That's interesting, isn't it? That was Dame Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner for England, talking about the government's plans for SEND. It's coming up to 22 minutes past two. In the next couple of minutes, hang it in the Louvre. You might have muttered about that photo of the former Prince Andrew. Well, somebody actually did. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. With Wickes, the kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all of the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit your local Wickes store.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight. No fake news, no flag waving, and no Trump derangement syndrome.
Fascinating week in Trumpland, MAGA-land, what used to be called the United States of America.
Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
JP Morgan Personal Investing gives you the clarity to make more informed decisions on your investments, which is great because right now, something else just became crystal clear. Your kid just outgrew the kids' menu. Now he's ordering a truffle gnocchi? You consider making a don't gnocchi it till you try it joke, but now's not the time. Now's the time to grow his world, one bite at a time. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wickes.co.uk.
Now, you saw it in the headlines, you saw it as memes, and a select number of people even saw it displayed in the Louvre. He's sweating now. That is the tagline accompanying the photograph of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor slumped in the back of a Range Rover after he was released from police custody. Everyone Hates Elon, which is a protest group, shared a video of its members mounting the picture in the French Art Gallery before it was taken down by staff just 15 minutes later. Art critic Estelle Lovett joins us now. Estelle, it is an era-defining photograph, isn't it, that one? Is there anything uncomfortable about trying to call it art?
Well, the thing is, it's an image. You know, if we're going to discuss, can a photograph be art? When the camera was invented in 1839, the Impressionists asked the same question as you. But now, of course, you know, we accept video, we accept sound, we accept installations. We have to move with the times. Why did they put it in the Louvre? Well, it's how we are going to remember Andrew, isn't it? It's that defining moment. And of course, art talks to us, whether it's two-dimensional or three-dimensional sculpture. Art talks to us in ways that transcend language barriers. And it's very immediate. The unusual thing about it is that the photographer, Phil Noble, obviously didn't expect it to be ending up in the Louvre. And if you think about how artists use the power of protest in their art, we've got Ai Weiwei, we've got Picasso, Goya, Banksy, the Guerrilla Girls, but this is something different. This is accessible to everybody. Everybody around the whole world has seen that image. So it's not that the image is a work of art, but it's just that this group of protesters are getting their message across. We're talking about it.
Yeah. Do you know what their message is?
Yes. So their message is that he can't sweat. Well, he can sweat now, isn't it? You know, from, as you say, from that three-word headline caption, he's sweating now from the sun. And it's taken to make us think, actually, what's going on? Do we need the royal family? How much protection do we need to pay for him? Is he worth it? Is he just telling fibs? You know, it's different to, if you think about the protests of Just Stop Oil, when they threw soup at Van Gogh's sunflower, when they covered Constable's famous The Haywain painting with an image to do with climate issues. Even Picasso's image, Motherhood, that was a way of the protesters talking about a two-way arms embargo with Israel, go figure. A bust of Queen Victoria covered in porridge and jam. The Mona Lisa covered in cake. You know, what does it do? It makes us think. And it's unfortunate because it's making galleries suffer. We need tighter security. We need more bag searches. We need to ban liquids. We need increased surveillance. And, you know, for some of the protesters, some of the Just Stop Oil, when they got 2 years or 2 years and a couple of months, and others were acquitted, is what's the balance that we need to protect our artworks? And then other people are saying, well, is art more important to life? You know, these acts distress visitors and staff. People have a right to protest, yes, but to damage artworks or to damage gallery walls or to damage frames, that's not how real artists do it. But as I say, we're talking about it.
Sure. Do you know which picture this photograph replaced? What was taken down for the protesters to put this one up? And how easy is it to just walk up to a picture and take it off the wall?
Well, it's not necessarily that a picture was taken off the wall. I mean, Banksy in the past has put up images in galleries where there's a blank space. So, you know, what can we do? Can we have a guard standing by every work of art? No, of course we can't, because then, of course, we're going to have to charge extortionate fees to go in.
Yeah.
And this artwork is owned by you and I. I mean, obviously, we don't have it in our home, but it's ours. You know, it's the nation.
But also, I think you make a very interesting point there, Estella, and I wonder whether our listeners this afternoon might merit actually a distinction between the protests that have, in the manner of the protest, damaged art and this which hasn't damaged art. Because, you know, actually, if what the protesters did was put this photograph up just on a blank wall, they've got the attention they wanted, it was taken down, that isn't as detrimental, is it, to the gallery as a Just Stop Oil protest chucking soup or paint or actually defacing a picture?
I mean, perhaps not, but who's to decide what's severe and what's acceptable? I mean, I don't think anything. Would you like it if somebody came into your house and put a picture up on the wall? And
no, you know, I wouldn't like it at all. But I bet at some point in the future there is a photography exhibition that has this picture in it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And that whether it's a picture of it up on the Louvre walls or if it's by Reuters photographer who has given his permission, Phil Noble, to use it. But these Everyone Hates Elon protest group, you know, what their aim was after they had their Warholian 15 minutes of fame, they said, I won't swear, they said they wanted to. They were peeing off billionaires one small action at a time. Do you think these billionaires care? No, I don't think so.
Well, we will punt that one out to our audience for sure, Estelle. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon, art critic Estelle Lover. Would you mind?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't think I would. I would mind. Yes, I would mind.
You would mind.
Nevertheless, that image has got to be, if that isn't the image of 2026... then heaven knows what's going to replace it. It's got to be, hasn't it?
It is era-defining.
I would have thought so. Next on Times Radio, violence across Mexico after one of the country's most powerful drug lords is killed by the security services. Could have an impact on the World Cup because some games are due to be played in larger Mexican cities. We'll talk about that and much else besides after the headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The man who killed three people in Nottingham in 2023 carried out an earlier attack after being released by mental health professionals. Valdo Calacane was let go because of the overrepresentation of young black men in custody. A public inquiry which began today heard that just 40 minutes after Calacane was released in 2020, he began to kick down a neighbour's door. He was then sectioned and released in late 2022. The Education Secretary says children with the most complex needs will keep the the highest level of support in English schools. Fewer kids are expected to qualify for special needs under reforms designed to ensure that more pupils can be taught in mainstream settings. Individual support plans will offer things including language therapy and teaching in small groups. Speaking to school leaders in Downing Street, Sir Keir Starmer said every party wants to see improvements on this.
This is the issue that's come up at Prime Minister's questions more than any other from all political parties in all parts of the country. That is really unusual. And that tells you something about the fact that the system does not work as it is.
And the Australian Prime Minister has written to Sir Keir Starmer to support removing Andrew Mountbatten Windsor from the line of succession. The former prince was arrested last week on suspicion of misconduct in public office. It's alleged he shared sensitive information with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Andrew has denied all wrongdoing. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Cathay Pacific brings you closer to Asia. From Tokyo's vibrant streets to Bali's serene shores. Indulge in world-class service, savor Michelin star dining, and lose yourself in our award-winning in-flight entertainment. Cathay Pacific. Move beyond.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations, and Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar, good afternoon, John. What's heading our way between 4 o'clock and 7?
So, mention a couple of things. We've got Jackie Smith, the skills minister, who's coming on to talk about, among other things, the SEND proposals that we got today. I mean, are they going to make things better? Are they going to do much, does she think, to tackle the problem of stigma when it comes to special needs in schools? Talk to her about that. I've got a Tom Tugan hat coming on, the former security minister, who seems to want, well, potentially pretty tough action where Andrew is concerned, former Prince Andrew is concerned. Obviously, say again, he denies all wrongdoing, but the possibility of a treason charge has been raised by Tom Tugan hat. I want to see why he thinks that and what he means by it. And also Mel Stride, he's the Conservative Shadow Chancellor. Student debt, that's a question for him. And also maybe he can respond to what we've heard from Reform UK today by way of more tough sounding measures on migration control. I remember Mel Stride was, not very long ago, a guy who opposed, wasn't convinced at any rate, by the idea of pulling out of the European Convention on Human Rights. So let's just see where his mind is moving. I'm also, by the way, interested in chimps. Chimps are flirting by way of, yes, well, of they, picking leaves
they
apart.
Tear leaves apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's one way of doing it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's compared to sort of the he loves me not thing, right?
Yes.
I wonder what goes through the chimps' minds. We'll find out.
Oh, have you got a chimp on?
I've got a professor of chimpology, if that is a thing.
A chimpologist.
Oh, wouldn't you love to be a professor of chimpology?
What do you call it? Is it primatology?
Primatologist.
Yeah.
I prefer
one of those.
We're going to stick with chimpology.
Yeah, I think that sounds very interesting. Thank you, John. I think Andrew should change his surname to denies all allegations. That might be easy. He's gone from something to Mountbatten Windsor. Why not just call yourself denies all allegations?
Denies all wrongdoing.
Denies all wrongdoing, yeah. You could double back, you could hyphen back. How many hyphens would you need in that? Quite a few. Just work it out. Mm-hmm. No, you can do it at home. 0333 003 2353. He does deny all the allegations of wrongdoing. Joe says, a clear agenda for these SEN reforms is to put power in the hands of teachers and schools and away from parents, who currently can at least try to shape and then enforce entitlements set out in EHCPs. Naturally, D'Souza, that's Dame Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner for England, she was on just before 2:30, and other educational establishment figures think this is great. Those of us who've been through the system know that teachers often don't do a good job in understanding special needs and generally don't listen or respect parents. The new approach will simply mean that all children are poorly served, as opposed to only some. And Rachel D'Souza's point was almost the exact opposite, that she feels this will benefit all of the children, and it won't just be those children with parents who are willing and able to fight for them who benefit. Mm. It's a complicated area, this, though, isn't it?
It is, and everybody's personal experience is very valid and feels to be the most important thing for you, and that is the problem for schools. Chris from Poole has a very simple one. I'd like it if somebody would be kind enough to put artwork on my wall. But Chris, is that artwork? That's our question.
Now, the killing of one of Mexico's most powerful drug lords has sparked a wave of violence, with revenge attacks and turf wars erupting all over the country. Mexican special forces, acting, we're told, on US intelligence, shot dead Nemesio Oseguera Cervantes, known as El Mencho, head of the Jalisco New Generation cartel. Street battles erupted in Jalisco, with gunmen blocking roads, setting fire to vehicles and attacking the airport at Guadalajara, which is Mexico's second largest city and which is due to host some of the FIFA World Cup games later on in the year. Benjamin T. Smith is a historian and author of The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade. Benjamin, thank you for being on the programme. Just put this into context for us. How significant was this man?
Thank you very much for this opportunity. So, the cartel he ran was very significant. It produces probably the majority of the fentanyl and methamphetamine that goes to the United States. How significant was this man? Probably not very much. I mean, the figure of the kingpin that we somewhat obsess over in popular culture, and the American government tells us is immensely important and is pulling all the strings of these cartels, that's just not true. He was a figurehead. A useful enemy, but in all frankness, his death will cause very little changes.
Well, did they mean to kill him, actually, or did they intend to bring him in?
I suspect they would prefer to have brought... Well, I think there would probably be two options here. One, yes, some people would like to bring him to have him in court, but at the same time, my suspicion is it was very convenient that he died, because he would have known lots of things that would have made him relatively unpopular among US and Mexican authorities.
And is it true that people of this type, so-called help the poor, and are in fact significant figureheads? I mean, you said he isn't actually all that important, but would he have been someone that certainly impoverished folk did respect after a fashion?
Well, I think you've got to break down these cartels to a certain extent. I mean, the other cartel that we often talk about and that gets lumped in together with the cartel Jalisco is the Sinaloa cartel, which operates about kind of 300, 400 miles to the north. Now, that cartel has a history of helping the poor, and it does help the poor. The cartel Jalisco hasn't really got that history. It's a relatively recent organisation, only has about kind of 10 years. Yes, in certain villages, certain places, particularly around... Mencho's hometown of Aguilia, has been known to give out money, give out food packages. There is no doubt they have that happened. And this is one of the very few sources of employment in a very poor area of Mexico.
What, helping out with the drug trade is a significant employment opportunity, is it?
So about 175, they estimate that around 175,000 Mexicans are at some level involved in the drug trade. That would put it, I think it's the third biggest employer in Mexico today.
Wow, the third biggest employer?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, it's vast, it's huge. Yes. And when I say involved in the drug trade, they're not only involved in the drug trade, they're involved in other forms of organised crime.
I see. It probably makes a lot of people, including myself, realise that Donald Trump's obsession with this, well, I mean, he might be onto something.
He's on something to a certain extent. I mean, there is no doubt that 100,000, or I think it has gone slightly down, but a couple of years ago, 100,000 Americans died of drug overdoses. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount. That's more, it's a vast quantity of people are dying of overdoses. Whether going after drug cartels in Mexico makes any difference, now that is a different question. In my opinion, it doesn't at all. In actual fact, my suspicion is that that this will in no way affect drug overdose rates in the United States whatsoever. What it will do, and I think what we will see over the next few months, are intense battles for supremacy within the surviving members of the Cartel Jalisco.
I see. So they will fight amongst themselves, and local people, presumably, don't want to get caught in the line of fire. It's going to be pretty tough for them, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think here we've got to focus somewhat on what the Mexican government has been doing over the last year. Remember that the World Cup is coming up in a few months and will be held in Mexico. The Mexican government, over the last 14 months, claims to have brought the murder rate down by 42%. Now, if so, that's kind of extraordinary. They've halved the murder rate in about a year. I think, personally, that's highly dubious, and I think the killing of Menchor will be very, very difficult to contain.
Why? What could happen next, then?
Well, Menchor is not the first kingpin to have been killed or captured. I mean, depending on what you're calling a kingpin, over the last 20 years, about 250 kingpins have been killed or captured, and it's done nothing to the supply of drugs. What it does do... is it means in the direct regions that these kingpins allegedly control, you get intense, violent competition between the surviving members of the cartel for supremacy.
Is there any way of tackling this problem then? You don't seem to think this method is likely to work. What could?
Well, to a certain extent, I mean, there's a very simple solution, which is you'd legalise... you would at least take one source of profit away, would be to legalise... drugs in the United States, but I doubt very much that that's going to happen.
No, but imagine, can you just explain, I've always been interested in this, if that does happen, what would the immediate impact be? Let's start with Mexico.
Well, it is quite difficult. Well, we legalised, or America de facto legalised marijuana about 10 years ago, and that did radically reduce the amount of income that... cartels got, and it also meant that they didn't dominate certain populations which used to grow marijuana to survive. The problem is that they simply turn to other narcotics. They turn to methamphetamine, they turn to fentanyl, they turn to heroin. So it didn't actually, it caused a slight slowing down of the cartels, slight kind of loss of income, but they more than made up for it with the synthetic drugs that they're now importing.
I see. So by that logic, though, if America did legalise everything, then there would be a proper impact.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, again, I don't believe necessarily legalisation is necessarily a silver bullet for this, because they would presumably move into other forms of organised crime, such as kidnapping and extortion, which they're pretty good at and involved in already.
Gosh, it's a gloomy old picture in Mexico, isn't it? Which does mean that I've got to move on to the World Cup, and I don't want to be too parochial about this, but I don't think at the moment that England or Scotland are playing any games in Mexico. I hope I'm right about that. But could games be cancelled? I mean, Donald Trump is perfectly capable, we know, of just moving fixtures, especially as he's such a big mate of the FIFA boss, back to the States.
Well, I think that there is that possibility. I think if... the cartels, I mean, one thing that's very clear from having studied this for 10 years is cartels incredibly rarely disrupt international tourism or international travel. They really, really rarely kill foreigners. The reason being that if you kill a Mexican, you'll get away with it. If you kill a foreigner, you won't. The level of impunity for murder is somewhere like 98%. So 98% of murders are not solved.
Wow.
Whereas if you kill a foreigner, there's about 100, you will get prosecuted. So they won't, I suspect they won't go near the World Cup. But I think what people should know if they do decide to go to the World Cup in Mexico, is that about an hour from one of the main stadiums in Guadalajara, about a year ago, they found a place that they now call the Mexican Auschwitz, where they found two massive industrial ovens and the bone fragments of at least 1,000 people. So if you do go there, you're basically going to be stepping on a huge mass grave.
Yeah, this is such a grim business, isn't it? We mustn't lose sight of that. The impact potentially on the president, Claudia Sheinbaum, I mean, she's been around for a year or so, hasn't she? And seems to have, I was going to say, forged some sort of working relationship with Donald Trump. What would you say about that?
Yeah, no, I think she has. I mean, I think she's been relatively successful at doing this. It's an incredibly difficult tightrope that she's on. On the one hand, she is a fairly broadly kind of left-leaning president who is doing a fairly good job at redistributing wealth to the Mexican people, like her predecessor. At the same time, she is continually under threat by a very right-wing president in the United States who's continually making threats. So she's got to play this extremely carefully. And it seems up to now she has. I mean, there was a huge fear after what happened in Venezuela that the US would send in troops into Mexico to try and take out cartel members. And it seems that Claudia Sheinbaum has managed to stop Trump doing that, which is relatively impressive.
Thank you very much for your time. Benjamin T. Smith, historian, author of a book called The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade.
So it's interesting to just have a bit of a ponder about how much the drugs industry in this country is worth. Figures going back to 2018, and I'm using those because they come from the Institute of Economic Affairs rather than from any of the think tanks and lobby groups promoting the legalisation of cannabis. That valued the UK's black market in cannabis alone at £2.6 billion, and they were estimating that legalising cannabis would raise £1 billion a year in tax for the UK. I will try and find some other figures for you about harder drugs, and certainly the type of drugs that were being referred to there, which have yet to swamp our market, because as yet the UK has stayed relatively immune to the true terrors of the opioid crisis. But interesting to note that Lord Hague called on the government to consider legalising cannabis for recreational use back in 2018. It's a topic that we kind of go to in waves, don't we?
Yeah.
And it never seems to quite make it onto a manifesto. And you can't help but think that's because you and I are of the age group that turn out to vote. But I think we just have a different generational attitude, actually, towards the legalisation of drugs. But next time around, Jane, with a lower voting age, what might happen?
Good point. Well, you can always tell us what you think. 0333 003 2353. It's Times Radio. What have we got next?
Could AI have helped catch a killer? That is in our tech news with Chris Stokel Walker. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow. All the latest national and international breaking news and informative interviews. Plus, hear unrivaled journalistic expertise and detailed analysis on the radio programme where sharp insight meets original thinking. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio with ServiceNow. The AI control tower for business reinvention. Find out more at servicenow.com.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Experience award-winning itineraries from aboard small, luxurious ships with Oceania Cruises. Discover the finest cuisine at sea and exquisitely crafted dining experiences. Enjoy gourmet specialty restaurants and open-seat dining at no additional cost. With over 600 destinations to choose from, explore the world with Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon. Opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Everything's computer.
Oh, hello you. The data centres needed to power the government's AI revolution would need more electricity than Britain uses at its peak. This is one of the stories we're going to talk about with our tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker. Chris, can we do the last one first, though, so we don't run out of time? Because this story about OpenAI considering alerting Canadian police about a school shooting suspect months ago is extraordinary. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, the unfortunate experience of Jesse Van Rootselaar, who
ended up shooting 8 people in a relatively remote part of British Columbia last week, then killed herself. It turns out that the Royal Mounted Canadian Police have said that actually OpenAI was aware that she had been talking about something like this 7 months before she actually did this. So back in June 2025, OpenAI staff were alerted through the systems that track how we interact with these chatbots that actually something was going on here that might have required some sort of intervention. So it was raised up the flagpole internally within OpenAI. They have policies that say that they have to only report this to police if there is a real imminent threat of this, and apparently it did not cross that boundary, so they ended up not doing so. But of course, it is a massive, scary moment to think about, actually, could this crime have been prevented had OpenAI been able to talk about that with authorities a little bit earlier?
I mean, it's beyond a terrible missed opportunity, isn't it, for all of the families who have lost their children, their partners, husbands, etc. Has there been any firm action taken to change the level at which any AI has to report what's going on and what questions are being asked and what conversations are being had to the police?
Well, OpenAI hasn't necessarily said that they are changing their policies. Of course, they came out and said that their thoughts were with those who were affected by the incident, that they proactively reached out to the police in this question to say, yeah, we had learned about this a little bit earlier, perhaps there might have been something we could have done. And they say that they're going to continue to support the investigation. I think if we take a step back, this unfortunately isn't the first time that this sort of thing has happened. We obviously have heard about, in the past, individuals, young people generally, who have taken their own lives and have talked about whether or not they might want to do that with an AI chatbot, and has come out in the course of either a coroner's investigation or something else that actually that was happening. I remember talking, I think back in August, with us about a similar sort of incident of a suicide there. So, you know, these things continue to happen. I think it is incumbent on the AI companies to think about their role in this and whether or not they can just be passive observers. Of course, the challenge is, Fee, whether or not actually someone was to follow through with the actions that they talk about with the chatbot, or if they're just simply talking.
Yeah. And just to be clear, because a couple of our listeners have already got in touch, the school shooter was born a biological male but was identifying as a she. Can we talk now about the story that's made it to the front page of the Times today? Now, something that has been on our horizon of anxiety, Chris, for quite some time, which is this extraordinary amount of energy that is needed in order to power the AI revolution, that's just going to cost us all in the long run, isn't it?
Indeed. I mean, this is something that the US is grappling with. This is something that Europe is grappling with. And it's unfortunately something that we're going to be grappling with. So Ofgem has come out. Obviously, the energy regulator oversees large parts of our energy system and knows what's coming down the line. They say around about 140 data centres have requested grid connections, so to be hooked up to the national grid. And they say that combined, those 140 data centres, if they all come online, of course, which is a big if, given there are all sorts of issues around, can they get permitting, can they get the equipment, can they manage to get the requisite funding. But if all of that came together, that would be around about 50 gigawatts of energy capacity drawing from our grid. And the context of this is that at our peak day in February, we are around about 45 gigawatts. So we're effectively, if all of this comes to pass, doubling the energy capacity that will be pulling from our grid. And yeah, that is difficult because we're already pretty stretched in terms of various energy resources.
So governments, and we can't be alone in this, Chris, have they just been caught on the back foot or actually just been really stupid not to realise what the cost of the AI revolution is going to be?
I'll leave it to the people who are listening to think about whether or not they think the government is stupid. That's probably far beyond what we want to talk about, and everybody will have their own minds up.
Let's
but I would
say
suggest
a government, not the government, then. Because, yeah. I mean, to be honest, if Jane and I were discussing it a couple of months ago with you, it can't possibly be the case that, you know, whole government departments haven't been hard at work on
You'd
this.
Think,
You'd think
you?
And hope.
you would think and hope, and I think that they have recognised this, but I think that the speed and the scale of this has caught them on the hop, because frankly, you know, you have to have long-term planning for this sort of stuff. These are massive infrastructure projects, and the reality is that, you know, even when the government was planning this and the civil servants that support the government were planning this, even before the Labour government came into power, they were probably not factoring in the idea that ChatGPT would come along and change the world in November 2022, and then that we would have this agentic AI revolution that is happening now. And I think that there is a fundamental shift here. So for context, that sort of capacity that we're looking at is about five times greater than previous government assumptions on this in terms of how they would reach a clean energy grid. So that is a big problem. But yeah, I think the reality is not all of this will get built. So they will be hoping that some of this kind of winnows away along the next few years.
Okay. I'm looking for joy in our next news item, but I'm not finding it because this is yet another warning from inside the world of AI about what AI might present the world with. And it seems, Chris, that the only people who leave AI are the people who want to tell the rest of us that something very troubling is happening.
Yeah, indeed. An awful lot of people end up leaving the AI sector and going on to do things like poetry. One person who is in the AI sector still very much is Sir Demis Hassabis, who has been talking at the Indian Global AI Summit that just finished up last week about what he sees as the real risks and the importance and the imperative of regulation on this. Now, we need to be conscious, Fee, that you know, these companies are always going to say they need regulation. Oh, and by the way, we can help you figure out how to do that, governments, and have a lending ear to help support you, but actually it means that's pretty good. But I do think that there is a sort of shift that is going on in the next few months, particularly because of the last few weeks, actually, and the rise of agentic AI. There is a real fear here that actually the intelligence of AI has improved leaps and bounds just in a few months, and the AI labs themselves know the direction we're going in. I think what they see is quite a powerful tool that we do need to try and grapple with.
Lovely. That is a little bit of light, isn't it, at the end of our dark tunnel. Chris Stoker-Walker.
I needed it.
Always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Anne says you just glossed over the fact that the Canadian shooter was a man. We didn't. We said that the person involved was a biological male who identified as a she. I think that tells you everything. But look, keep your thoughts coming. 0333 003 2353. It's that difficult time of the afternoon. It's nearly 3 o'clock. It's not quite. Nearly.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is now. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. We're here for another hour. In the next hour, it's almost 4 years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the country's potential next president has been speaking, and we're going to hear exactly what they've been saying in the next hour. We'll also talk about England's collapse at the weekend or Ireland's brilliant performance. Pick the one you like. Vassos Alexander will be with us. He's also talking about calls on a potential new Olympic winter sport, one we could be good at. We'll also open the doors of our literary salon with the Times Books team, and Adam Shaw will tell you how to save money on your car insurance. First, the news at three, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The man who killed three people in Nottingham in 2023 carried out an earlier attack after being released by mental health professionals. Evaldo Callaghan was let go because of the overrepresentation of young black men in custody. Ollie Cole has more details from the Times newsroom on the first day of a public inquiry.
Callaghan, who killed students Grace O'Malley Kumar and Barnaby Webber and school caretaker Ian Coates, had a mental health episode in May 2020 when he tried to kick down a neighbour's door. He was arrested on suspicion of criminal damage and underwent a mental health assessment. While one doctor had considered sectioning Callaghan, a wider team decided to release him because of the number of black men in detention. Rachel Langdale, counsel to the inquiry, said that just 40 minutes after Callaghan was released, he began to kick down another neighbour's door. Calicane was then sectioned but was released in late 2022 despite refusing to take his medication and not engaging properly with staff.
A new level of support for children with special educational needs and disabilities is going to be implemented in England. Fewer kids will be eligible for the highest tier. Ministers hope that offering language therapists and specialist teacher training in mainstream schools will enable most children to be taught there. Reform UK says it plans to deport more than 600,000 people in a potential first term in government. The party's pledging to create an American-style immigration enforcement agency to remove illegal immigrants. But immigration lawyer Ivan Sampson says reform will come up against several legal obstacles.
This country has legal safeguards to prevent summary mass removals. That's unlawful. And we'd also have to withdraw from the European Convention on Human Rights, which I think they've already said they would do that. But also we'd have to withdraw from the Refugee Convention.
Non-emergency travel by road has been banned in New York City because of blizzard conditions. Millions of New Yorkers, as well as many in the northeast of the US, have been stuck at home as forecasters warn of up to 2 feet of snow in some areas. A meteorologist says he's expecting conditions to rapidly deteriorate. And the picture of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor in the back of a car, taken after he was questioned by police on Thursday, was put in a frame and briefly hung in the Louvre in Paris. It was put there by a protest group called Everyone Hates Elon, with the title He's Sweating Now. It was removed by staff after 15 minutes. Arts critic Estelle Lovett says this kind of thing is thought-provoking, but a nightmare for galleries.
A bust of Queen Victoria covered in porridge and jam. The Mona Lisa covered in cake. You know, what does it do? It makes us think. And it's unfortunate because it's making galleries suffer. We need tighter security. We need more bag searches. We need to ban liquids. We need increased surveillance.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
We have plenty to entertain you in this hour of the programme. We will talk about books with Susie Goldborough. We have Money Matters with Adam Shaw every Monday. Can you see what we've done there? And today we're going to be talking about how much you could save in your car insurance. Are you diligent with your renewals?
I think you're going to ask me if my car was... Yes, it's insured. She said, Anna, just
looking
up the paperwork.
Yes, I'm very... What do I shop around to get a better... Well, I don't really. I'm afraid I'm one of those dullards who just probably... Do you leave it on auto-renewal?
Well, it's been known.
Yeah. I think Adam's going to tell you something about
I know
about
he is.
That.
He's going to tell me I'm an idiot.
Well, there is a peak time, a couple of months, before you need to renew your car insurance when you can get an absolutely superb deal. And then it just creeps up and up and up and up and up. And if you leave it on auto-renewal, so many people find they're suddenly paying £150 more than they did last year. And if you don't investigate it, that is just the price that you pay.
In my experience, when I've had better years and I've been more on it, when I've rung up because I've had my renewal offer through and it has gone up, but there's been no reason I haven't made any claim, they just bring it down to the original level. If you do challenge them, they will just take it down.
But isn't that cheeky?
Well, I suppose it is.
You have to phone them, you have to notice, and then they will offer you a better deal. All of that will come our way after 3:30 this afternoon and sport with the mighty Vassos Alexander. Are we still calling him that or are we just Vassos?
I dropped it last week.
Excellent, just Vassos. We'll be here in about 20 minutes' time as well. It's 5 minutes past three and it's almost 4 years to the day since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now Ukrainians say the war is threatening the stability of the Russian regime itself. That statement came from a speech by the country's ambassador to the UK, General Valery Zaluzhny. He is the man who commanded Ukraine's army as Russian forces crossed the border, and he was speaking at the Chatham House think tank.
The military economy, filled with huge expenditures on defence orders and payments to mercenaries, must be approaching a breaking point. It is very important for us to continue to strike at the sources of Russian income in parallel with the financial support of our partners. Among the main measures should be a reduction in purchases of Russian energy resources and the fight against the shadow fleet, especially in the Baltic Sea. Of course, Russia will have money for the war until the very end. However, it is important to understand that restrictions on its economic capabilities and isolation must be irreversible and the only thing that can lead to the end of the war.
Well, let's talk now to Keir Giles, who is a senior consulting fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House. Keir, very good afternoon for us. You were listening to the general today. Can you tell us what else you heard in that speech that you might bring to our listeners' attention?
I think some of the most important points that came out of his speech were lessons from Ukraine for the West. And it's not the first time he's delivered a speech like that, saying that the war on Ukraine has been transformative in terms of how wars are fought, and Western countries, including the UK, he fears, are not keeping up. He's talking about the introduction of artificial intelligence, of drone swarms, of the way there is no longer a front line. Instead, there's a kill zone, which is 30 kilometers wide. All of these are things which have been observed by Western militaries, but it's not clear how rapidly they're adapting to them. Plus, of course, all the messages about how to bring the war to an end and how not to.
Is he quite openly critical of a European strategy and us in particular?
He hasn't said that specifically, but then he doesn't need to. The defense insiders in the audience all knew exactly what he was referring to when he talked about the way not just war fighting, but the economies of countries are being transformed by what's happening on the front line in Ukraine, because they've been arguing for the same thing for years as well. Looking at the way that the British Armed Forces, for example, when they go to Estonia to take part in exercises with Ukrainian opposition, seem to be trying to fight a war as though it were 2021, and some of those defense insiders hope that they're being soundly defeated by this new style of warfare is going to serve as a catalyst for change.
I read a very interesting piece, Keir, that you had written just about the heavy lifting that is being done by countries like Estonia and Finland and the smaller Balkan states. I mean, you know, to our detriment, those are countries and it is a part of the world that we haven't discussed very much until the Ukrainian situation. And we really need to understand exactly what is happening in those countries and what they need. They are a first line of defence, aren't they?
Well, as so often, it depends who the we is, because those countries have been jumping up and down, pointing at the Russia problem for far longer than anybody's been paying attention. But also, they're not helpless. They're taking matters into their own hands. They know what's required to deter Russia. And when we think of them as tiny countries, like Estonia, for example, it's easy to forget that they are focusing on defense so much that they have the mobilization resources to be serious players in their own right. When the Estonian armed forces mobilize, they have land forces of 50,000. Which is not that far off the whole size of the British Army, which has been reducing steadily. So they're not helpless, and they have also been investing in ways of deterring Russia by striking into Russia itself to make sure that if Russia does make a move, the damage isn't going to be limited to the victim, but Russia itself will feel the effects straight away.
And tell us a bit more about other things going on, like countries withdrawing from the Ottawa Agreement. What's the significance of that?
All of these countries along the front line, along the northeastern periphery, have invested hugely in border fortifications because they've seen what happens in Ukraine. They know that they can't let territory and still more people fall into the hands of the Russians, because then they know what happens under that savage Russian military occupation. So what they're focusing on is stopping people on the border. And if you go to visit the Polish border with Belarus, you'll see rows of tank traps all wired together. You'll see spaces for the anti-personnel mines to be introduced as and when they're available and when there's an increased state of readiness. But to have those mines, of course, all of these countries had to withdraw from the convention which banned anti-personnel mines that they signed up to in a much happier, more peaceful age.
So that's the Ottawa Agreement.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Can you cast your mind back to 4 years ago? It is almost 4 years to the day since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. There is so much more that we know now about Russian aggression. But when that happened 4 years ago, Keir, what were your thoughts about, say, the initial 6 months of a campaign?
I was one of those people who, right up until a couple of months before the invasion, was not believing that it was going to happen. Despite all the intelligence releases, it was plain that it made no sense, because it was obvious to people who had looked not just at Russia's military, but also at the Ukrainian armed forces as well, that this was not going to be the pushover that Russia and apparently the United States were expecting. Instead, it was bound to be a quagmire. So after the initial few days of fighting, when it was plain that already that Ukraine was not going to be an open door for Russian forces to walk in, it was just a question of how much support Ukraine's backers could provide. But now, of course, 4 years on, we're in a very different situation, because both of these two countries, Ukraine and Russia, have their coalition of backers. Both of those coalitions, for their own reasons, have decided not to intervene decisively, and so the war drags on.
And what do you think will happen now?
It seems that the balance is tipping back in Ukraine's favor. And that's not just because of the issues that we heard about from Valery Zaluzhny at Chatham House today, such as, for example, the increased pressure on Russia's economy, but also because of that static front line and the way Ukraine has adopted another new strategy of exhausting Russian reinforcements more rapidly than they can be brought up. So Russia is still using its personnel as bullet sponges. It's still trying to drag people in from across the country to throw them into the meat grinder on the front line, but the trend is now against Russia. This is something that has come and gone throughout the course of the whole conflict. Now the edge seems to be with Ukraine. And the only wild card, of course, is Russia attempting to make life unsustainable in Ukraine's cities by destroying their power infrastructure, making sure that people are cold and freezing and in the dark. That, if it does succeed in making life simply untenable, would be one way in which Russia could win, but it's not going to be on the front line.
Sure, and we can't underestimate the horror of that for Ukrainians themselves, can we? Can you tell us a little bit more about General Zaluzhny and what kind of a man he is? He's often spoken of as the next president of Ukraine, likely to be the next president of Ukraine. What does he bring to that party?
It's true, he is often spoken about in those terms, and that's something he's acutely sensitive of. Right at the very beginning of his Chatham House speech today, he explained how he was going to be staying well away from those domestic political issues. He said, any word I say at the moment will be seized on and turned into a quote as rapidly as a drone destroys a horde of orcs, meaning the Russian troops that they hunt with drones on the front line. So he was extremely careful not to make the situation with political confrontation within Ukraine itself any worse, because all of the stories that we hear about pushing for an election are, of course, what Russia wants to happen. It's not in the Ukrainian constitution to hold an election of that kind within wartime, but Russia sees there an opportunity to destabilize Ukraine, not just a new leader, not just a potential change of power, but even the process of the election itself and the amount of disruption that would bring, with so many soldiers on the front line, so many displaced people across Europe, and the amount of damage and disruption it could cause is one reason why the United States is pushing for this Russian demand that an election should be held.
President Zelensky is charismatic. He is determined. He has done a remarkable job on the world stage. Is the general cut from the same kind of cloth?
He's certainly charismatic. He certainly has presence. He can certainly grip an audience. And, of course, he has that track record of being the wartime commander, the leader of the troops. So if he did come to an election and he did decide to mount a serious challenge to Zelensky, no matter how damaging it might be to the country, then it's not impossible that he would have a serious chance at winning an election. But we are a long way from that, because it's well understood just what a terrible idea that would be.
It's very hard to imagine Russia without Putin at the moment, Keir, isn't it? But that will happen one day. If that were to be sooner rather than later, what happens in Russia? What happens to Russian aggression?
Well, again, those of us that watch Russia for a living, we spend quite a lot of time trying to imagine Russia without Putin. But the sad news is, of course, that it won't make a great deal of difference. Putin is not inventing the reasons why he's invaded Ukraine. He's just acting on these long-standing Russian ideas of Russia's place in the world. And it's not just him who believes this. There are tens of millions of Russians who think this is a good idea. Some of them, of course, would be in the running to replace Putin if he were finally to go under a bus. So we shouldn't expect that there'll be any change to what Russia is doing just as a result of the change of who's sitting on the throne in the Kremlin.
He won't go under a bus, though, will he? I mean, he's one of the most guarded men on the planet.
He's well guarded, yes, but nobody's immortal.
Okay, let's clip that bit. Thank you very much indeed. Really interesting to talk to you this afternoon. We very much appreciate your time. That is Keir Giles, who's a senior consulting fellow in the Russia and Eurasia programme at Chatham House. Can you imagine in our lifetime Russia without Putin? He is such a solid figure on our global horizon, isn't he?
It would be quite satisfying if he were to take a tumble out of a window, like so many of his enemies.
An unsafe balcony.
Yeah.
Well, there are many.
Yeah, there would appear to be, yes. But let's not wish. Actually, no, it doesn't matter. We can. We can wish it. He's simply a nasty piece of work.
I'm a bit worried for you now.
So, been worried about me for a long time. It's Times Radio. It's 17 minutes past three. I do have this thing about 3 o'clock, and Glyn is backing me up. He says, thank you, Glyn. 3 o'clock is simultaneously too early and also too late to do anything. And that's right. It's that really challenging time of the day. If you haven't achieved what you half hoped to, there's no point doing it. And equally, I don't know, it just, there's no good, what's good about three? Because at four, you can have a cup of tea. Everybody knows that. But not at three, somehow.
Well, I think for many people who are listening at home, in fact, we're the first week after half term.
Aren't we at home? I don't know where I am. It's nice, though.
I am even more worried about you. So I think you do need guarding on the way home. You trip up without any help at all. What was I saying? We're back in school term time, aren't we? And I think 3 o'clock just always after you have had kids and been on the playground pick-up duty, 3 o'clock is a klaxon in your head as to the time at which your day just changes into the other job that you do until they leave primary school. So for me, it's a kind of bittersweet hourly visit.
Okay. You can always let us know what your favourite time of the day is. 0333 0003 2353. I think it's that time of day where it's 5 o'clock somewhere, that time of day.
It is. Do you know what? I don't like 11:15.
Don't you? Okay. Nope. Right, it's sport with Vassos Alexander in a moment here on Times Radio. He's got a new idea for a winter Olympic sport, and we are going to interrogate England's shocking performance on Saturday afternoon in the rugby, and also honour just how good the Irish were as well. Of course we are. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Carol Walker on Times Radio.
We'll have all the latest on the revelations from the Epstein files as some MPs press for greater freedom to debate the conduct of the royals. We'll take you through the front pages of tomorrow's papers, and a BAFTA award winner with Tourette's syndrome shouted a racial slur during the ceremony. We'll discuss the mixed reactions.
Carol Walker, tonight from 10 on Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Experience award-winning itineraries from aboard small, luxurious ships with Oceania Cruises. Discover the finest cuisine at sea and exquisitely crafted dining experiences. Enjoy gourmet specialty restaurants and open-seat dining at no additional cost. With over 600 destinations to choose from, explore the world with Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
The Winter Olympics in, was it Milan Cortina?
Yes.
Came to an end, didn't they, yesterday?
Yes,
Vassos
they did.
Is here, we're talking sport. And there are calls now for, a tug of war. Oh, I don't know. And apparently there used to be Olympic medals for art until 1948. And now there's a new suggestion.
Yes.
Listen to this, right?
Okay.
And this is a proper bid. This is a proper bid for inclusion at the next Winter Olympics. Snowball fighting.
Well,
I know. This is from a Japanese town. Where it's a major event, there are corporate sponsors, there are teams competing from across Japan and all over the world. Like 1,000 people descend on this Japanese town once a year for the World Championships of snowball throwing. Teams of 7. Each team gets 90. Look at this. If you want to have a look at on the Times Online, just look how satisfying these perfectly machine, milled snowballs.
There's
look.
Nothing homespun about them, is there?
No. This is sort of snowball fighting, kind of professional meets pro sport.
Right.
And each team gets 90. There are teams of 7. You get lots of kind of referees, 8. Per 3-minute section, there's a little wall where you can. I mean, it's basically you against your neighbours. It's but sort of on a grand scale with spectators. Obviously, it's not getting into the Winter Olympics.
Well, I don't know.
But
honest, you've seen the stuff that does get into the Winter Olympics,
break dancing in the Summer Olympics last year at the to the absolute horror of sports like squash, who. Year after year after year.
Gosh, you don't want to horrify the squash community.
No, well,
the
IOC have horrified the squash community. I think squash is in, actually, for LA.
Oh, God, don't tell me paddle's in.
No, paddle is not in.
Oh, God, the paddle community will go bonkers if they ever get that.
But darts for years was trying to say, look, let us into the Olympics. I mean, there are certain criteria that you absolutely need to be an Olympic sport. One is a governing body that everyone recognises, anti-doping programmes that tick boxes. Of gender equality, you have to be transcontinental. I think played in more than 70 countries.
So that's why cricket can't get in to the Summer Olympics.
Exactly.
Okay.
But then there are sort of certain things that the IOC really like, which is how does it improve kind of like youth eyes on the Olympics? How does it make us seem more relevant? How does it make us seem more trendy? How does it make it look on television? I mean, no one would suggest that, getting snowboarding and half pipe skiing into the Winter Olympics has been a bad thing. They look fantastic. So this is a cheeky bid from the Japanese sport of snowball throwing to be included in the next Winter Olympics. And I think well done to the Japanese sport of snowball throwing for having it go.
My colleague has a question.
Yeah, I've put my hand up.
Yes.
So please, sir, Mr. Alexander.
Yes.
I don't understand that list of criteria that you had there because with regards to the Winter Olympics, I mean, there are loads and loads of countries across the globe that don't have representation in the sports that the Winter Olympics
100%
provide.
So I think the Winter Olympics criteria are somewhat lower, especially in the sort of transcontinental things.
Yes,
So
they can have their snowball.
They can have their snowball because it'll look good on television and we'll all watch and we might do quite well, you never know.
So I don't understand, do you have to aim it at a target or do you have to take your opponent out?
So there are you capture the flag or hit every other member of the opposing team with snowballs.
So it's paintballing, isn't it?
It's basically paintballing.
Yeah, they've probably got a cheaper cafe. It's paintballing cafes where they make the money.
I didn't know that, but it's a good tip. I always remember it very rarely snowed in the Mersey Riviera of my childhood, but when it did, the primary school headmaster would give a truly blood-curdling warning in assembly about the dangers of snowballs, because if there was a stone in a snowball, you could take out a kiddie's eye.
Or ice.
Well, there would be ice.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if there's a, if it's a block of ice
rather than a block
of snow, then that's sort of. Whereas these things pictured here in trays with very official looking people carrying them, they look. I mean, I wouldn't mind one of those in the face. That's almost quite satisfying.
I think it probably would still hurt, however beautifully designed the snowball.
Well, the competitors wear helmets. In this, snowball
fighting. A load of wuzzes.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Right, well, it's not happening. But it was a diversion anyway, thank you.
You never know. I wonder, if an Olympic gold medal is the absolute pinnacle of the sport, I think it deserves more serious consideration for inclusion. For example, Tom Daley's at the top of a 10-metre platform, and he knows in the next 1.3 seconds, which is how long it'll take him to hit the water, that his next 4 years hangs on the next 1.3 seconds. No one really remembers who wins the European Diving Championships or the Worlds even, but everyone remembers the Olympics. I was there in Rio when it went all wrong for him in the semi-final, and he was absolutely crestfallen. I told him by the side of the pool, I said, this is just, your life is such a movie, Tom, that this is the low, and then in 4 years' time you'll get the gold, and he did, which is great.
How did he react to that when you said that to him?
Oh, he was so... I gave him a hug. It felt like a human thing to do, you know. Mm. And he went, well, maybe. I don't think it went in, to be honest, but I'm so thrilled for him that he has, you know. Yeah. But something, and something like snowball fighting, absolutely, that would be the pinnacle of the sport. But then you include something like golf. You think, well, it's such, or even tennis, it's such an add-on, you know, an Olympic gold medal. Whereas Wimbledon or, you know, the US Open is the real pinnacle of those sports.
They're the biggies. If you were going to participate in an Olympic sport, what sport would it be, Jane?
Oh, God. Well, if they ever were to do sitting down darts, I'd give that a whirl.
Now, Vassos, you're
very... They've done poetry before. There have been Olympic Games of Poetry in 1926. And the guy, Baron...
She's not that old.
Pierre de Coubertin.
Yeah.
Who founded the Olympics, the modern Olympics, he won the gold medal in poetry, having sort of just squeezed it in.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
I know.
We saw that one coming, Pierre. What would your sporting discipline be?
I would love nothing more, and in my dreams I often do win an Olympic marathon gold medal.
Do you really?
Yeah.
And are you way out in front?
Oh, do you know what? I've always pictured myself on the podium. I haven't actually pictured the race, but if you want me to picture the race, what would happen is I would enter the stadium neck and neck with one or two other competitors, and it would be an absolute lung-busting lunge for the line right at the end, and I would just come through.
Yeah. Kieran's not impressed. Just says, for the love of God, get onto the rugby.
We're trying to avoid
that. Are you
that,
Irish,
Kieran?
By any chance? Okay, England were woeful. I mean, I was watching it with my dad. He had plenty of opinions, none of them broadcastable. Mm. I always feel I can plug into my Irish genes when Ireland do well in the rugby. So I regard it as a triumph, frankly. But England were bad. Why were they so bad? Or should we just acknowledge how good Ireland were?
Well, no, Ireland were fantastic and England were absolutely terrible. So we just transfer the word Ireland from the word Scotland this time last week. You know, Scotland were great and England were terrible. This time it was at Twickenham. Ireland's record win at Twickenham ever. I mean, they got double the points of England, 21-42.
Very satisfying.
We mentioned the New Times writer Charlie Morgan online and on the app. And I think in many respects, this is like the future of sports punditry. He goes right into the detail of why Ireland did this well. You know, I wonder when sports people come off the field and they get asked, I don't know, has it sunk in yet? I sort of don't care whether it's sunk in yet, but I do care. Why did you do that then? And that's what Charlie Morgan's thinking. So this is why England, they were in the 22, they were in Ireland's 22. This is why they didn't score. This is why Ireland picked England apart again and again and again. And it's really because embedded in the article online is like clips of it going round and round and round. So have a look at this. OK, get that right. Now, this is what happened. And then have a look at this. And that's why it was a try. It was fantastic, actually. But questions are going to be asked about many of the England team and, in fact, of Steve Borthwick, who came into the Six Nations talking about...
He's the coach,
the possible Grand Slam decider. England against France in a couple of weeks' time in Paris. It's the last game of the Six Nations, and I suppose England had won 12 games in a row, so why not? But that looks a little bit arrogant now, and we're going to Rome in 2 weeks' time. And honestly, England could lose to Italy for the first time.
Well, Italy, I've got a limited understanding, but Italy have played pretty well, haven't they, so far? So that you're right, that's a game to watch, actually.
Well, they beat Scotland, who beat us, and so
England. Why not?
So, you know, you draw a form line from that, and they pushed France close, they pushed Ireland close. Yeah, if England are ever going to lose to Italy, I'm afraid this might be the Six Nations.
OK, in your fantasies about winning the marathon, are you running for Team GB or for Greece?
I suppose because it's the Olympics, I would have to run for Greece, but I sort of don't mind. So when England play Greece at football, it's really lovely for me because I kind of want both teams to win and both teams to score. So I don't mind.
That's good of you. OK, thank you very much. But in his fantasies, he's Greek. Vassos Alexander, who will be back with us tomorrow with some more sporting intel at about 3:15. What's the matter?
It's just the way you said that. Is he Greek in yours as well? Listen, I'm knee deep in a barrel of tarama salata in my dreams. Men don't figure.
Coming up, we open the doors of our literary salon. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The man who killed three people in Nottingham in 2023 carried out an earlier attack after being released by mental health professionals. Valdo Calacane was let go because of the overrepresentation of young black men in custody. The counsel to a public inquiry, which began today, said that just 40 minutes after Calacane was released in 2020, he began to kick down a neighbour's door. He was then sectioned and released in late 2022. Supports for children with special educational needs and disabilities in England's mainstream schools is being changed. Individual support plans will offer things including language therapy and teaching in small groups. The highest level of help and education health and care plan will be restricted to children with the most complex needs. The Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson says no child will miss out.
Being aspirational for children with SEND shouldn't be radical. It's common sense. It's simply believing in them. This is about improving their support, not removing their support. No child will have to leave their school.
British people in Mexico are being told to stay inside after violence broke out following the death of the leader of a drug cartel. The man known as El Mencho was killed in a military operation. And the BBC's apologised after a racial slur shouted out at last night's BAFTAs was broadcast. The public broadcaster says the comment arose from involuntary verbal tics associated with Tourette syndrome. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
It's probably nothing. That's what Jack always thought when he felt a bit dizzy after physical exertion. He was only 17 and a keen basketball player. He was playing basketball when he had a cardiac arrest and collapsed. He was rushed to hospital and ended up on a life support machine. Jack was diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a serious but rare heart condition, and his chances of survival were believed to be just 8%. Jack's surgeon believed they could avoid a heart transplant. He underwent an 8-hour operation and was later fitted with an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, an ICD, and a pacemaker. Jack is now at university studying software engineering and getting on with his life as a normal teenager. British Heart Foundation is funding groundbreaking research, including pioneering gene therapies, to fix the DNA spelling mistakes that caused Jack's heart to stop. So when you donate to British Heart Foundation, you're helping to fund life-saving research. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Joss says, you can tell you to have been broken up for a week. You're hyper, even if no tarama salata was consumed. Well, I did think it was a low blow to suggest that I was in any way involving our colleague in thoughts.
You're making it worse.
No, I am. Let's just talk
about
books.
Let's leave it. It was in the last half an hour. Nobody will notice.
I was knee deep in
We've moved on. Don't, Ryan. Don't. It is 26 minutes to four. The doors to the literary salon are open for another week. In steps Susie Goldsborough, Deputy Literary Editor of The Times. Hello, Susie. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well. I have my tub of tarama salata in hand.
Well, everybody should bring a little hors d'oeuvre to our proceedings. We're going to start off talking about Grown Ups by Marion Keyes. Now, this is a rather glorious novel, isn't it? And it's Marion doing what Marion does best, which is chucking a bunch of people together and defining each other's lives through them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. They're sort of really choral novels, aren't they? They're always based around a network of people, usually a family, a big Irish family, as this one is. And yeah, I totally agree. It's sort of Marion doing what Marion does best. And to me, part of what she does is she kind of settles you in very comfortably and it feels sort of soft and welcoming, almost a comfort read. She's got this kind of lovely tone. You know, her dialogue's great. Her characters are sort of warm. But then there's always some real darkness in there. And this is, you know, this is a dark book. It covers sort of partner loss and bulimia and tragic death. And she really kind of stares life in the teeth, but somehow it always feels like a bit of an escape to me, and that I think is her great skill.
I would absolutely agree. So when you start one of her books, I think you can think, oh, this is just going to be cozy and lovely, it's all going to be in a major key. But it is the minor key that comes into it that keeps you reading her books, and her books are long, aren't they? You have to dedicate yourself to a Marion Keyes.
You do, which sounds like a slog but isn't, although this time I read this one on audiobook, which was a real treat. She reads it herself in her lovely Cork accent, which I won't try and replicate here. But yeah, you kind of sink in, and you can kind of get lost in one over a whole weekend or a week or a few weeks, and that's part of the joy.
If people haven't read a Marion Keyes before, would this be a good one to start with, or should we go back to her earlier stuff?
No, you know, I actually think this would be a great one to start with, because it's, yeah, I think it's 2020, it's a more recent one, and she's just really at the top of her game. But then also, I know there's the telly adaptation of some of her earlier books just starting on the BBC, which are about the Walsh family. That's sort of Rachel's Holiday, that famous series. So you could also start there and then watch the TV show.
Right. We're going to move on to The Bottle Factory Outing by Beryl Bainbridge. My colleague has informed me that she's got a Beryl Bainbridge anecdote.
Right. Well, it's a bit limited, but Dame Beryl Bainbridge, she was made a dame, went to my school, and she was expelled for writing a limerick on the back of the loo door about the headmistress's knickers.
Can you tell us what the first line of the limerick
was? I can't,
was?
I'm afraid.
Is it too rude?
No, I mean, it was quite rude. Okay. I think it was relatively spicy. I think this must have been, judging by the age of Beryl Bainbridge, this would have been in the 1940s or 50s that she was expelled. But, I mean, it's a great shame that the school expelled easily its most revered, I mean, you know, obviously, it's most revered people.
Second most revered.
Yeah, well, no, let's not kid ourselves. But it is, I don't think it says a lot about the institution at the time that she got into such trouble for writing it. I think the headmistress was a formidable lady, because her portrait hung in the hall. I remember she was called Miss Brash.
Miss Brash.
And I don't think...
Well, that rhymes with rash.
Well, that's my issue.
Perhaps
I wonder.
That was the limerick. Yeah. Okay.
I wonder whether Beryl had simply gone too far.
That could have been a great, great limerick. Rhymes with trash as well, doesn't it? Can we name the school? I mean,
no,
it's easy
for
people to look up.
No, it's closed now, anyway.
Okay, it's closed.
Beryl and I between us closed.
Okay. It never recovered.
Well, it was a very good anecdote.
It was a great anecdote, because
Thanks,
it sounds like something from a Beryl Bainbridge novel.
Well,
so it gives readers a flavour. She sounds exactly like one of her own characters, which I think does make sense, sort of known to be autobiographical.
Yeah.
But if you want more such anecdotes, read The Bottle Factory Outing.
Now, tell us a bit more about the book.
So I came to this one and another one, An Awfully Big Adventure, because Daunt Books are republishing a bunch of her novels next month, and they're doing a lovely job, so look out for that. And this one, The Bottle Factory Outing, is drawn from an incident in her own life where, I think it was in the 1970s, she was sort of dirt poor, single mum living in Camden. She had a job at a bottle factory, bottling Italian wine, with mostly a bunch of young Italian male immigrants and a couple of girls who was her, including her. And the book is all about a day outing for the workers, where they're going to go and have a picnic at Windsor and have a lovely day. And that's often the case with the Beryl Bainbridge book, I think. They sound, when you describe the plot, like kind of sweet, quite twee stories, which is kind of desperately misleading, because these are black as pitch, kind of macabre gothic horror, sort of pathologically unsentimental, I mean kind of brutally so, and just so brilliant.
Okay. An Awfully Big Adventure is another one by her that you'd like us to note. Same kind of thing,
or slightly softer, so might be a better one to start with. Also autobiographical, this one set in Liverpool in the 40s, where she was a child actor. She was actually in Coronation Street at one point, I think. But this is set in the Liverpool Playhouse, about a kind of teenage girl who's doing bit parts and helping out backstage. And again, it sounds really sweet. It's about this repertory company trying to put on Peter Pan. But again, it's just one of the saddest novels you'll ever read, while being very funny. I want to give you a sense of how, I don't know how to give you a sense of how dark this is. Oh, I have a, may I please read out one sentence, which I wrote down.
Oh, God,
yeah.
Please.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So at Christmas, it's Christmas time at the Playhouse. And so we just have this throwaway line. In the middle of the Thursday matinee, a Salvation Army band began to play carols in the square, and Rose sent out a donation with a request for them to move further off. And that's a Beryl Bainbridge sentence. You know, you think you're at Christmas and it's carols and it's lovely. And then there's just this deep misanthropy at the end of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when was she at her most prolific? Because both of those novels are about young women, aren't they? Did she equally write about the ageing process in women?
She did. I think, so she was extremely prolific. And she wrote 18 novels, I think, and she was shortlisted for the Booker 5 times. She wrote a bunch of novels early in her career about young women, which were autobiographical. And then I think there are some with slightly older protagonists, but what she really did was move on to historical fiction. So she kind of ran out of her own material and started writing novels about, there's one about young Adolf Hitler. There's one about an elderly Victorian curate who murdered his wife. You see again, the kind of Bainbridge sensibility. So her historical novels are also a lot of fun.
It was Young Adolf, I think, that book.
Young Adolf, exactly, yeah.
I think, wasn't that based on the rumour that Hitler had come to Liverpool?
Exactly, yeah. It's about Hitler getting into scrapes in Liverpool. I mean, you have to have a certain sense of humour to like these sort of books, but I think she was, what's odd is how little she's read now, given how fantastically popular she was, you know, 30 years ago, which is why I think Dawn republishing this is kind of exciting. But yeah, if you like really, really bluntly dark books, which not everyone does, but I do, these are certainly worth looking at.
Well, I think those are fantastic recommendations. Also, how cruel to be nominated 5 times.
Book of Bridesmaid.
Never to win. You'd just give up going to the ceremony, wouldn't you?
I know. I don't think she did, though. And it's a shame because she was a great public figure, and she came up with so many brilliant quips. You know, I think she once said that she hated contemporary fiction. She'd only read From Graham Greene backwards, which is a nice line. And so, you know, she would have given a great speech. She would have been drunk. She would have been smoking. It really says a lot about the Booker judges, I think, rather than Beryl.
Yeah.
Didn't she? I think she had some stuffed animals in her hall or something.
Did she? I didn't know
I never met her or anything, but I've always been fascinated by her. And I know she did have this incredibly gloomy house in Camden, which she had filled with various taxidermy
gothic
tributes.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, which kind of fits in, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, yeah.
Was the one of them filmed or televised? I think it was An Awfully Big Adventure. Was that
it
a
was,
film?
Yes, with some quite well-known actors who escaped me now in this moment.
Well, we'll look it up in a moment. Please. You can't know everything. Please. I was interested earlier when you said that you had listen to a book you claim to have read. Do you count listening to an audiobook as reading? No, I'm interested because I know a lot of people say they're a bit sniffy about audiobooks, but you would say you have read the book if you've listened to it.
I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, I've seen every struggling for language here. I've kind of ingested every word and to the same extent. So I do think it does count. Mm. It does. I know what you mean, that it feels like cheating, but that's quite nice.
Yeah, I don't think, I'm not judging at all. I mean, I listen to my audiobook every time I get on the tube. Okay. Yeah, I'm there.
Takes you away from the tube, which is really all you need.
Well, it does, which
and
can be a blessing.
What happens, I'm not a convert to audiobooks at all. I just can't keep the information in. I really enjoy the actual process of reading. And one of the things that I love is that I can pause if I just need to have a bit of a think about something. Or if I've read something just really amazing, I can just read it again and laugh again or cry again or whatever it is. So what happens when you're listening to a book? Do you do the same thing? Do you pause it to have a bit of a kind of moment with the words?
You can do, can't you?
Yeah, you can. I think you're right. That's something that reading's better for, because it's a little bit of a faff to pause and go back. And sometimes you realise you have missed a bit and you have to do that. And that's slightly annoying. But then it just does have these other advantages, like you're doing the washing up and you're so bored. And it just sort of feels like, like a little cheat that you're reading while you're doing something else. I think that's kind of great.
Yeah, I wouldn't condemn it at all. I just think it's horses for courses.
Yeah.
I can't do the Kindle thing either.
Oh, no. But it's nice to have real books, as Nick say, look good on shelves. I'm very shallow.
Well, yeah, I like the touchy-feely bit of them, and also seeing how far I've got in a book. That's sometimes... sometimes it's the only thing I accomplish in a day, Susie. I've done a centimetre of a novel. That's it.
I should say I'm interviewing one of my favourite authors this week. Ellie Griffiths is back.
Oh, yeah, with great Griffiths.
I love Ellie Griffiths. And she's got this... It's another of her time-travelling books. Have you ever read the book? It's The Killing Time is her new one. And the previous one was the first one in this time-travelling series. And honestly, she does have a way of convincing you that time travel is by no means an impossible feat. And we probably could all be doing it quite soon. And I'm keen to have a go.
I look forward to it.
Mm.
Who's the main protagonist in
Ali
that?
Dawson. Is okay. She's a detective who works for a secret police unit.
And this is now quite an in conversation here, but if you've taken to her books yes. and Ali as the heroine,
yeah.
does it mean that you have to push aside Dr. Ruth Galloway, who has to be surely one of the best creations in crime fiction ever?
You can like them both.
Can you, though, genuinely?
Yes, they're very different women.
But Ruth can't time travel, so do you look back
at
her?
Well, she can time travel. She's an archaeologist, don't forget.
Oh, good.
So she is time travelling.
Right. Anyway. Well, look, we went right into the weeds there with Susie, and we enjoyed it very much, and we'll come back.
Whether anyone else did is questionable.
It's all right, we've got car insurance next. A return to reality. We were talking about Grown Ups by Marion Keyes and two of Beryl Bainbridge's novels. The first one, The Bottle Factory Outing, and the second one, An Awfully Big Adventure. Susie, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
At ease. It's good. Stuffed peppers next time, please.
Stuffed peppers. I think it's good that old Beryl's getting a reprint and a relaunch. It's good. Good for her. Right, it's Times Radio. It is 13 minutes now to 4 o'clock. And next, how can you save cash on your car insurance? It's Joan and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Step out of your ordinary and discover something new on a Cunard voyage from Hayes Travel. Book selected 2026 and 2027 voyages before the 2nd of March and enjoy 10% off. That's 10% off the Norwegian fjords, transatlantic crossings, Europe, the Caribbean and more. This offer must end March the 2nd, so book your Cunard voyage with a low deposit at Hayes Travel today. Conditions apply. At all protected.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Adam Shaw is here putting his headphones on. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
Yes. No, thank you. Now, we always talk about rising costs, or quite often we do, let's face it, and all the problems we face. But there can be good and very welcome news occasionally. And the cost of car insurance does appear to be falling. Mm. Why is this? And how do you save £1,000 on car insurance?
It's good, isn't it? Saving £1,000. Sorry, I've still got my hat on.
It's all right. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, he's a middle-aged man. Sometimes they wear their baseball caps in the house.
No, sorry.
I don't judge.
Mistake.
I do.
Okay, yeah. Back to more important matters.
Okay. Yeah. So why is car insurance going down?
Yeah, it's an odd thing that it's been going down. But it is really clear the average cost of cover in the sort of last quarter of last year was about 10% lower than the same quarter of the year before. So it's quite a big move. And it's surprising partly because the cost of fixing any cars, because it's got so much tech in it now, sensors and cameras and all sorts of stuff, the cost is still rising. That is odd, isn't it? Part of the reason, I think, is the fall in the cost of whiplash claims. Now that has happened for a couple of reasons. There is a new portal on which you can claim for whiplash. It is easier to claim, but it's got a tariff. So whereas before, never having gone through this process myself.
Have you gone through it, Fee?
No. So, but I think maybe it was quite complicated and you weren't sure what you could claim and it involved lawyers and therefore that bumped the cost of everything up. Actually, now there is an official government-approved portal through which you can go, and there is a list of what you can claim. The whiplash, I've written it down, the whiplash compensation varies from £240 to £4,215. And the website is www.officialinjuryclaim.org.uk. Careful if you put this into the website, because there are lots of...
Oh, there'll be some dodgy ones out there.
Well, there were similar-sounding ones. This is free. You should not be charged for any of this. And the idea is that it makes it easier for you to run it by yourself. Weirdly, you'd think that would lead to a deluge of claims that would cost them more. For some bizarre reason...
I don't get that.
No, the costs have gone down. This is all good news. Let's not question the good news sometimes, right? There are real benefits to be had out there if you're renewing there. So really be price sensitive.
Okay. Now, Fee very sensibly asked me earlier whether I was one of those people who just went with the old renewal when it comes through from the company you're currently with. And because I'm really quite profoundly lazy, I normally do.
Right.
I clearly shouldn't.
You clearly obviously you shouldn't. So having put that to one side, there are a couple of tips. One is, weirdly, you'd think, well, let's go to a comparison site. That's an obvious thing to do. The comparison sites, though, don't all have a view of the whole of the market. So you really should be using a couple of comparison sites.
Oh, dear God.
I'm afraid. I know. But it could save you £1,000, Jane. Yes, I mean, this is not a small sum of money. You could also, we were talking about this on last week's programme, use AI. I mean, in fact, we've seen shares just, I think, today and overnight in America, in some of the big companies behind these comparison sites fall very significantly because it was felt that they had a sort of fortress of knowledge that you had to use these comparison sites. Now, AI models are seeming to get that knowledge, and that is an absolute challenge to their longevity. I mean, what on earth would a comparison site do in 5 years' time if you can go to ChatGPT and it does this all for you? So go to a couple of comparison sites. The other thing is timing. There's a curious thing about when to actually look for renewal. So if you do the renewal on the day you need... Is that when you do it? The 24 hours beforehand,
well,
you think my insurance is going to run out?
Sort of rolls on.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. So, of course, you never...
It's April.
Yes,
I know I renew in April.
Right. Yeah. 26 days seems to be the sweet point before renewal. You get your big price change. Now, MSE did some study in this, and they found for the same policy renewed on the day it was needed, and comparing that to asking for a price 26 days beforehand, saved £1,000. That's probably because they go, well, you need this policy in the next 6 hours. You're really stressed by, you're going to buy what we offer you. 26 days, well, she can move around. We really got to bring her in here. Friends of mine have asked their insurance broker or their insurance company, why is this cheaper? And they've come up with spurious reasons which don't really make much sense. I think the person on the phone doesn't know. It's a black box algorithm that has decided this. But it is worth comparing a couple of comparison sites and doing it around 26 days beforehand. I think there's £1,000 to be had there.
26 days. OK, I shall make a note of that, I promise.
Put it in your diary. Yes.
Well, it's not
something to look forward to, Jane.
Yes.
Thank you,
Fee. I don't know. It's the high point of my diary. Oh, it's insurance renewal day.
It'll be sort of mid-March when I can look forward to that. Yeah. Many thanks, both. Right. I mean, I have also heard... Well, actually, I'll just be honest. I've done this myself.
Right.
My premium went down, and I don't really understand why, when a friend of mine who'd given up her car, I put her on my insurance because she occasionally needs a car to visit her mum. Mm-hmm. So why bother having your own car when she could just drive mine, because I don't often need it at the weekends. So put her on and the insurance went down.
Yeah.
And then another friend also went on the insurance. So two of them are now on it alongside me. It went down again.
Right.
Why?
Can we all write in and just ask to be on your insurance? Jane Garvey's
I've got a Mini, and I'm like a lot of people in London. I have a car because I occasionally need to get out of London, and I do love my car. I like driving, but I honestly don't need it 7 days a week.
No.
And if other people do, I'd much rather they borrowed mine.
And it's an ecological... I mean, you've got a car sitting there.
I'm all for the environment.
I get that. So there are a couple of things. As with the days beforehand, there are algorithms which really are inexplicable in plain English. But when I have asked insurance companies about precisely that, and a similar thing actually getting cheaper insurance if you buy comprehensive insurance rather than third party. Well, comprehensive insurance is a much better product, really. It insures you for lots more things. You'd think it was a much more expensive. The answers have been weird, but take them at face value. On the point you raise, they'll sometimes say to me, oh, well, this will be sharing the driving, so it lowers the overall risk. The average risk is now lower. And that might be because of the jobs you do. So people in the media often have a higher premium. I asked about that and said, oh, you could have an Oscar winner in your car. And I promised them it was so unlikely that I would have an Oscar winner in my car that we could have an accident. But they went, it's what it says on our form. That bumps it up. But if I was then sharing that with a teacher, for instance, my overall risk might be lower.
I see.
And the comprehensive insurance issue, they have said, again, whether this is true or not, but this was the answers I were given, was that, you're now worried about your own car. You're trying to insure your own car. That's a sign you're a much more careful driver, and therefore it might reduce the risk. It doesn't always play out that way, but sometimes it does.
I don't understand the logic in this at all, because I would have thought there's far greater risk of somebody occasionally driving a car that they don't drive on a regular basis than there is risk involved in their profession. I know some right old racy teachers, right, and I know some very boring media personalities.
Yes,
Adam.
Yes, thank you for looking directly at me.
At least she wasn't looking at me.
She meant me. No joke at all there.
Yeah.
No, look, I agree with you, but the insurance industry are good with numbers. They will, you know, they're very cold-hearted about this.
They're about making money.
They're about making money. Yeah. You know, they will have looked at these figures, and this is what they'll have decided, despite the racy teachers and boring radio presenters,
No, I said media personalities.
Well, I was just stretching it away from me a bit.
Thank you, Kate, for your backup. She said, I had that too when I added my sister, which I assume that her payment went down when she added her sister. Yeah. So the no-claims bonus. Mm. I mean, no-claims bonus is an expression that I've used in my life if I'm completely honest, Adam, understanding what it means. So can you take us through that?
Yeah. Well, if you don't claim on your insurance, the insurance company really likes that. And it goes, here's a woman who either doesn't have accidents or doesn't claim. We will reduce her premium on the amount of years she hasn't claimed. No claims, as you get your no claims bonus. It can be really significant. I've heard of 60% discounts because of that.
60%?
I mean, it can be really big. And if you move insurance from one company to another, you should make clear how many years no claims bonus you have.
Mm.
There's an added thing there. You can pay for a protected no claims bonus. So you go, what I will do is actually pay you a little bit extra, and I can make a little claim, and it won't affect my no-claims bonus.
I see. So you have to think a little bit carefully about
You have to think
that,
a little bit. And it also makes the whole thing, this is true of the whole of insurance, is it worth claiming? I claimed for some household insurance, and it wrecked my premium for years, and no one else would insure me. And you had to go, well, really, this is just a personal thing, and it's very hard to know what the effect of a claim will be. It's impossible. But I now only claim if it's mega, because I don't want to affect my premium history.
No, I mean, with house insurance, it's not a legal thing. You don't have to have it, do you?
No, but you don't want your house to fall down. No, you're quite right. No, you do have to have it, but there are questions. Well, we were talking about no claims bonus. Do you claim for a little scratch? I mean, if your car's collapsed, it's one thing. Mm. If there's a little scratch here and there, it's an interesting question to pose. Should I claim on that or not claim on that? What does that do to my no claims?
We probably don't have time for this now, but the real problem for, I know so many people whose children have battled for years to get, you know, have driving lessons, and then pass their test if they're fortunate enough to get a test. And then you discover that to insure them on even a pretty basic vehicle is going to cost you thousands.
Yes. I mean, I could do something specifically on young people, because I think there are ways of helping that. But the short line on that is it's very expensive, but it can fall very quickly after 3 or 4 years. I've experienced that. A sudden drop in the insurance, and they go, she's been driving for 4 years. It's much better now. So, there's pain, but it does go away.
Adam, thank you as ever. Adam has written a car insurance brief for us. You can find it at themoneydoctor.tv and on his socials at Adam Shaw biz.
Alexis Conran has been in touch to say, bizarrely, today is Clean Monday, a huge national holiday in Greece. It's the start of Lent. Traditionally, you go out and fly a kite, and then you eat tarama salata, which is why I thought you were talking about it. That would be too sensible. We were talking about Vassos Alexander's dreams. Our producer today was Felix Forbes, tech operator Ryan Boyden.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The man who killed three people in Nottingham in 2023 carried out an earlier attack after being released by mental health professionals. And a new level of support for children with special educational needs and disabilities is going to be implemented in England. And coming up, we're going to talk to a parent and a founder of SEM Parent Support Group, Andrea Dixon-Boldy, about the impact on families and why the former security minister Tom Tugendhat is calling for a treason probe into Andrew's links to the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The man who killed three people in Nottingham in 2023 carried out an earlier attack after being released by mental health professionals. Valdo Calicane was let go because of the overrepresentation of young black men in custody. A public inquiry beginning today has heard that just 40 minutes after Calicane was released in 2020, he began to kick down a neighbour's door. He was then sectioned and released in late 2022. Calicane killed students Grace O'Malley Kumar and Barnaby Webber and school caretaker Ian Coates. Here's Barnaby's mother, Emma Webber.
This inquiry must not become a procedural exercise. It must expose the systemic failures that allowed these warning signs to be missed, risk to go unmanaged, and responsibility to be diluted. It's not about isolated errors. It's about whether the systems designed to protect the public are fit for purpose. And they're not.
Sir Keir Starmer's asked his standards advisor to investigate a minister accused of paying a PR firm to look into the personal and religious backgrounds of Sunday Times journalists. The Times understands that Sir Laurie Magnus will look at whether Josh Simons has broken the ministerial code. Reform UK says it would deport more than 600,000 people in a first term in government. It also says it would restore Britain's Christian heritage by, among other things, stopping churches being converted into mosques. Home Affairs spokesman Zia Yusuf says renewing Britain's Christian faith is vital to tackle a crisis of cultural meaning. But Church of England priest Sally Hitchener has told Times Radio she has reservations about this.
Historically has been characterised by a Christian country, but that hasn't always meant we've had Christian values. If you think about some of our history, we treated other people in other countries in the world. I don't think we would necessarily want to replicate that if you're wanting to be following the teachings of Jesus. I think actually Christianity works best in a pluralistic society where there's freedom to choose.
Donald Trump has hosted the families of people affected by crimes committed by illegal immigrants at the White House. The US president calls them angel families. A student nurse, 22-year-old Lakin Riley, was killed by an illegal immigrant 2 years ago today. Her mother, Allison, has thanked Trump for his focus on immigration.
You are doing a thankless job that most people just wouldn't do. And I just can't thank you enough. There are just not enough words to say, because if you've lived the nightmare that we have lived, you understand the importance of the job that he's doing and securing our nation. And this happened to my family. This could be any one of your families.
Trump has been heavily criticized after two people were killed during raids by the ICE enforcement agency. And after their successful Winter Olympics, Team GB are back home. They landed at Gatwick with their five medals, three of which are gold. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me.
It's maybe hard to understand what it's like, how hard it can be to get decent care and schooling for a child with special educational needs and disabilities, unless you're one of those parents. Harder still to understand how hard life can be for a child with special educational needs, which come in so many forms, unless the child is you. Many struggle. Some suffer so badly it blights their lives. In extreme cases, more than a few take their own lives. So is today's plan to radically change schools' special educational needs, SEND schooling, the answer? Many homes will pray that it is, and we will be talking to parents, to a school head, and to the Times policy editor who's been looking hard at the government's proposals. I wonder what you are thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or tweet to @TimesRadio. And a little later, proper scrutiny of former Prince Andrew's conduct while he was a friend of the billionaire convicted paedophile has come late. I'll be talking to a former minister who is keen to get MPs on the case and wants the question of treason to be among those things that are considered. Firstly, let us talk about the government's announcement today. Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, talking about generational reforms being needed to change that system that's been criticised by parents, by teachers and by charities. Here is the Education Secretary speaking this morning.
The policies I'm unveiling today aren't extreme solutions. Being aspirational for children with SEND shouldn't be radical. It's common sense. It's simply believing in them. So parents, please hear me when I say, I believe in your children. This is about improving their support, not removing their support. No child will have to leave their school.
So that's a Bridget Phillipson. Now, the £4 billion funding will be for mainstream schools so they are better able to accommodate SEND children. We can talk to Ollie Wright of the Times policy editor. Hello to you, Ollie.
Hello.
Ollie, welcome. And do tell us about the essence of this plan and how the government says it's going to improve what we have now.
Yeah, I mean, there are two sort of somewhat conflicting aims to this. The first, as you just heard from Bridget Phillipson there, is to improve SEND provision, because I think there is a general feeling and correct feeling that, you know, it isn't very good. There's a huge amount of money put into it, but the results are suboptimal. But then there's a second thing, which is that huge amount of money that is being put into SEND, which has gone up exponentially over the last 5 years. And the government wants to rein that in, and they are acutely aware of the sensitivities surrounding this subject. So these reforms are going to be phased in over a period of pretty much a decade. As you heard from Bridget Phillipson there, no one who is in a school at the moment will lose that educational right that they have, but there will be quite significant changes. One of those is that people who have what is known now as EHCPs, they will be reassessed for those certificates when they move from primary school into secondary school. Now, that is an area of contention for the government, and there is some concern amongst parents that their child might lose the provision that they currently have. But the message from the government is very clear. You know, this isn't about saving money, this is about improving outcomes.
And Ollie, how is the really, really steep increase in the number of children on these care plans, how is that explained?
I think it's explained because unless you have one of these care plans, it's almost impossible to get the support that your children need in the system. And this is one of the things that if you talk to those around Bridget Phillipson, they say that you're in this crazy system where, unless you have...
Ollie Wright. Have we lost Ollie Wright there, our policy editor at the Times? I think we... Have we got you back, Ollie?
I can hear you.
We got you back. We lost you there for a moment. You were just explaining the steep increase in the numbers we're talking about.
Yeah, there's been a huge increase in the numbers. And the reason why there's been such a big increase in the numbers is because parents have found that is the only route to get the support that their children need. And one of the things that the government wants to do is to reduce the reliance on these statements by, as you heard, increasing the provision for special needs in mainstream.